Well, this is church history. What language was the Bible, New Testament, originally written in?
Greek.
Excellent. And then it was translated into Latin in the 300s or 400s by St. Jerome. St. Jerome translated it into Latin. I like what the good Baptists say. Why don't we read it from the King James in the language that Jesus spoke? But the language that Jesus spoke was, or Aramaic, the Bible was written in Greek. It was translated into Latin by St. Jerome in the mid-300s. And then it stayed in Latin, you know, from that point forward. What's interesting, too, is that Latin was a very unifying language. Latin was the language of the scholars throughout Europe. So even though one may spoke German, one may spoke French, one may spoke English, Spanish, Italian, things like this, all of the scholars were taught Latin. So if you were educated in the universities, you had to learn Latin. So all of the scholars could all converse with one another. But the common people would get, you know, would hit those barriers. One person filled out a volunteer form on Sunday and said, and then there was other, you know, the different things that you could do in the church. And this person said, I can translate pig Latin. I thought that was great. All right, so today we're going to talk about the great missionary, St. Patrick, was born in the year 387. It's hard to get more Irish than St. Patrick. However, his father was a Roman and his mom was French, and he was born in Scotland. And so, I mean, you think of Patrick, how much more Irish can you be than Patrick? Well, he wasn't Irish. His dad was Roman, his mom was French, and he was born in Scotland. His parents were basically Romans, part of the Roman government in that area. But his mom, Concessa, was a near relative of the great patron of Gaul, St. Martin of Tours. So his mom was a serious Christian. So he was raised Christian. When he was 16 years old, the Irish, which were just rats in those days, came over and raided that area of Scotland where he was born and carried him off as a captive. Shaved his head and made him a sheep herder. And then the guy he ends up working for, this guy's name is Milchu, M-I-L-C-H-U. However they pronounce that, that's what it was. He was a Druidic high priest. So he was a captive there for about 6 years. But during all that time as a captive, he would pray and pray and pray. And he said it got to the point in his autobiography, he said, to the point where I would pray 100 prayers during the day and 100 more at night. To the point where it was so much fun to pray that whether I would get up in the cold, whether I'd get up in the snow or in ice, I wouldn't feel it at all. I would go out and pray in the rain and I just wouldn't even be mindful of the cold, the snow, the ice, or the rain. The spirit of prayer was so strong in me in those days. At a certain point, after you've been praying for 6 years like this, the Lord said, your ship is ready to sail. And he knew what that meant. And he knew that that meant it was time for him to leave. And he just walked away because he had been so faithful in his service to his master. He had gotten great leniency. And so at that point, he knew he could just walk. And so he walked away from his slave master. And he walks to the coast of Ireland, 200 miles away. And he finds a ship. And at first, the people wouldn't let him sail on the ship. But then he prays under his breath, and they change their mind. And they let him on the ship, and they sail and it takes him 3 days to get back to his native island of Scotland. But then I guess they don't land exactly where his home port, but they land somewhere far off, and they have a long overland journey. They run out of food, so they begin to mock him, and mock his Christianity, and mock his piety. And he says, the Lord will deliver us, and the Lord will provide for us all. And they just couldn't believe it. But he said that in great faith. And after he said that, a herd of pigs shows right up. And they butcher the pigs and they have a feast that lasts for 2 days. These guys were really impressed at that point. So from then he gets home and he has a reunion with his family. But he doesn't stay long. He knows that he's called. He knows that he's got to go back to Ireland and preach Christianity to that group. To the people that he left, he's going to go back as a missionary. But he knows he needs to get training. From that point, from about 22, for a number of years, I don't have the exact number, but he goes to France and he goes and studies under Saint Germain of Auxerre, A-U-X-E-R-R-E. Saint Germain, G-E-R-M-A-I-N, of Auxerre. Saint Germain of Auxerre was Patrick's tutor. He also studied at Saint Martin's Monastery in Tours, France, and also the island sanctuary of Larens. Anyways, it takes quite a while. There's quite a bit of study. There's quite a bit of time where he is apprenticed under these great minds and these great people. And just a tremendous time of preparation, tremendous time of devotion. And it's during this time that I believe that he starts getting the equipment that he's going to need when he goes back there. He's going to need a tremendous amount of faith to fight against these guys who are really deeply involved in the occult, deeply involved in druidic occultic practices. And he's going to go directly head on head with these guys when he goes back to Ireland. And so his preparation was quite lengthy. All right, so first they send this one bishop over there, and the guy just completely fails. He comes back to the mainland, dies in France, and Saint Germain then recommends Patrick. This guy's got the stuff. This guy should be the guy to go over. And so the Pope gives him his blessing, and Saint Patrick is sent over to Ireland, and he arrives in Ireland, and immediately the very first thing he does is that he goes back to his druidic slave master, the guy who, you know, he ran away from, and he goes and he pays his ransom. He goes and he brings the money to buy his own freedom. You know, what a great way to start out. This guy had lost an asset, and here he comes and he's going to pay his way. And so he does, and in doing so, you know, he really buys some favor in that area, and he can stay there for a little while. And so he's preaching in that area and converting many, many people and many of the other former slaves, or his former buddies, and he converts a lot of them to Christianity. And about that time, a druidic chieftain named Dichu, D-I-C-H-U, draws his sword to kill him. And this chieftain goes up there to just kill him because he's converting everybody and he's changing everybody to Christianity. And this chieftain comes out there to just cut his head off. And as he draws his sword to cut his head off, his arm is absolutely frozen. He can't move. He's just stuck like that. And it's said that overcome by the saint's meekness and miracles, Dichu asked for instruction and made a gift of a large barn. And this was the first sanctuary dedicated by St. Patrick in Ireland. By his meekness, not by his power. And what's so interesting is St. Patrick goes ahead and converts the entire island to Christianity, all through nonviolent means, all through just his meekness and his prayers and his piety. He converts this incredibly savage group of warring chieftains completely to Christianity. It says by the time that he left, or by the time that he died, 350 bishops had been ordained underneath him. This is a completely pagan, warring island of just these different tribes that are just clashing with one another in sword fights. And he converts the entire bunch, and not only that, he teaches and trains and sets up schools and ordains as bishops 350 different people. It's impressive. So, what happens, great event comes up very quickly, and the Supreme Monarch of Ireland has a special feast at a place called Tara, and he says that it was on March 26, Easter Sunday in 433, that the whole kingdom was to meet at Tara, and a royal decree goes forth that the fires throughout the kingdom were to be extinguished until a single blaze was kindled at the royal mansion. And so St. Patrick arrives opposite the royal mansion. There's a broad valley there, and he arrives on this hill called Slaney. Tara's at one end of this valley, Slaney's at the other end. Patrick arrives on the other end, and it says no fires throughout the entire kingdom until our signal fire at Tara is lit. Well, he just goes there, and he starts his bonfire on the other end. And then it said that the Druids at once told the king, "O king," they said, "live forever. This fire, which has been lighted in defiance of the royal edict, will blaze forever in this land unless it be this very night extinguished." This fire will blaze forever in this land unless it be this night extinguished. The reason was is that there was a druidic prophecy about a fire that could never be put out. There was a fire that would be lit that could never, ever be put out. Repeated attempts were made to extinguish the blessed fire and to punish with death the intruder who had disobeyed the royal command. But the king's and druid's efforts were in vain. The fire was not extinguished, and Patrick was shielded by divine power. On Easter Sunday, the missionary band proceeded in processional order to Tara. And they walk right up there, and the king's like, "Well, who are you guys? Tell me about who you are." And it said that at that point, on this procession, from one end of the valley to the other, that he picks a little weed that had three flowers on it, that had three leaves, a little piece of clover, and he uses the one stem and the three leaves to explain the Trinity to the Irish monarch. This is where St. Patrick and the clover, the shamrock, become so important. So he explains the Trinity to him, and he had of course lived under one of these Druidic priests. And so he knew all their customs. He knew all of their things. And so he had been studying and studying and studying in France under the Christians there, so that when he got back, he could confound and he could confront their practices, their doctrine, and their beliefs. And systematically, he went from one leader to the next leader to the next leader and converted the leaders of each tribe and of each town. He went to the top and converted the top dog in each place. And of course, you don't just get to walk right into the top dog's place. Frequently, he was jailed. Frequently, he was in prison. Frequently, they were going to kill him. But each time, God delivered him. Each time, God miraculously delivered him. And it's something like 12 times. He was chained up and sentenced to death. And each time, he was miraculously delivered. And the miracles and his humility converted his hearers. The miracles and his great humility confounded these incredibly warlike people. And God's hand was all over him, and God's protection was all over him. And so it's important that we see this style of missions. You know, there's the great pride and power and things like this, but there's also this great humility and meekness of somebody who goes in there, and it's in their humility and meekness that they see and are converted. And it's very similar to the story that's coming out, the point of the spear, about the missionaries who went to the Amazon jungle. The men go there and they start witnessing to these unreached cannibalistic tribe. While they even had guns, this tribe went ahead and attacked them and killed them. The men were killed, but then the wives dedicated their lives to going back there and reaching this tribe. And eventually the whole tribe was converted, including some of the men who were involved in that raiding party where the men, where their husbands were killed. And it's just fascinating, this whole story. But it's done through humility. It's not done through power, but it's done through the grace of God. When you have that kind of confidence in your God, you don't need a lever. You don't need anything else. You don't need money or force or anything else. You can do it when you know your God. When you know God, you're effective. It's very inspiring to me to read about this man who prepared and prepared and prepared, who prayed and prayed and prayed, so that when he went head to head against people who were deeply involved in occult practices, his power was stronger than theirs. And when they said, "I'm going to cut off your head," his power was stronger than theirs. When they came at him with the sword, his power, the power of his faith was stronger than theirs. This is where you've got to get with God. This is a challenge to you. This is here's where you are, here's where you got to get to, where you just know that you know that you know that when I pray, God is with me. I'm using my faith on little things right now. I'm believing God for this. I'm believing God for that. I'm praying for the next this and the next day and the next day and the next day. And each day the Lord meets me. And each day the Lord meets me. And each day the Lord is there. And I'm walking with God. I'm walking with God. Did you hear God's voice today? You need to hear God's voice every day. It's one thing to say, you know, I had a prayer time a month ago and I really heard God's voice. And you should walk in that. But you really can develop to where you hear God's voice every day. Every day. And it's that kind of relationship that will make you tremendously effective in every part of your life. It's this kind of faith that we want to develop in our life. A humorous story, it goes on to say that St. Patrick was leaning on his staff when he's baptizing the prince of a village. As he's going through the rites of the baptism, he's leaning hard on his staff. And then at the end of the ceremony, he notices all this blood on the floor, and he realizes that his staff, which had a very sharp point at the end, had been placed right through the foot of the person he had just baptized and he was praying over. and the young man had just stayed there and had just not even flinched. And he said, "Well, how come you didn't say anything?" He said, "I thought it was part of the rite. I thought it was part of the ceremony." Oh. And so St. Patrick took the point of his spear with the blood on it and wrote on the man's shield a great blessing to the man on his shield. That was part of the ceremony. It is recorded in his life that he consecrated no fewer than 350 bishops. It is sometimes supposed that St. Patrick's apostolate in Ireland was an unbroken series of peaceful triumphs, and yet is quite the opposite. The saint was subjected to frequent trials at the hands of Druids and of other enemies of the faith. He tells us in his Confessio that no fewer than 12 times he and his companions were seized and carried off as captives. And on one occasion in particular, he was loaded with chains and his death was decreed. Yet each time, the Spirit of God delivered him. Each time, God delivered him. Not only was he delivered, but the entire village was converted. St. Patrick, the great missionary. Next, I want to discuss St. Augustine, Bishop of Hippo. St. Augustine was born November 13, 354. Patrick was, of course, born in 387. So this is St. Augustine, born in 354. He's a Bishop of Hippo, which is now Algeria. But of course, at that time, it was part of the Roman territories. And Augustine grew up in a sort of an upper middle class family. He was a very brilliant young man. His mom's name is Monica. And Monica is, of course, a famous name right now because Monica, who eventually was called Saint Monica, his mother prayed for him. His father was not that much of a Christian and eventually became a Christian before his death. But his mom had this tremendous influence in his life. And it's interesting that Patrick's parents were Christian and had a tremendous influence in his life. Augustine's mom, Monica, Saint Monica, had this tremendous influence in his life. Although he was raised in a Christian home, it didn't really take for him. When he's 16, he gets sent off to school in Carthage. It was just before he was sent off to school, and then when he went off to school, that he just kind of falls into all the things that you can possibly do in those days. He just says, "I just fell into deep, dark sin." And in his first year at school in Carthage, he ends up fathering a child. And he had to work through all of these errors of his youth. And what's interesting is that, you know, he has a kid when he's 16 or 17. He ends up falling into this Manichaean sect, which really just tremendous error. And he just goes from bad to worse, and he just is in a mess. But this lasts for quite a while. And his mom, Monica, continues to pray for him. Monica just keeps praying for him. And eventually he becomes a teacher, and he gets a very fine education. He becomes quite a debater and quite a scholar. So eventually he ends up in Rome. Under a great saint there, he becomes converted to Christianity. But he is impressed, first of all, by the character of this Christian minister in Rome. The character of the minister, his kindness, was one of the first things that made an impact on him, because all of his teachers in his cultic areas, their lives were a mess, and their values were terrible. And even though what they said kind of was attractive, their lives were a mess. But yet this one Christian minister had it together, had true humility, and had true love, and his arguments and his conduct came together. And so he listened to this guy for 3 years. 3 years this man just continued to listen to his sermons. And there are many other stories of great Christians who didn't become a Christian overnight. And the interesting thing about that is that is that someone who becomes a Christian overnight can become a non-Christian overnight. Yeah, Dylan, Bob Dylan, there's a very good example. Yeah, he was in and then he's out. There was a lot of talk about Daryl Strawberry's Christianity. Are you really a Christian? Are you not a Christian? You know, he'd talk a lot about Christianity, and then he'd be in drugs again. And he'd talk about his Christianity, and he'd be in drugs again. It's like, ah, what is that? So your faith and your actions have got to go together. So Augustine was listening to this man, and his faith and his actions fit. And he listened, and he listened, and he listened. And then after 3 years, he was finally baptized and became a Christian. He goes on from that point to study Christianity, ends up becoming one of the greatest debaters of Christianity in that region. And he confounds all of the bad guys. The great leader of the Manichaeans comes to his area of Hippo, and they have this tremendous debate. And at the end of this debate, the leader of the Manichaeans completely capitulates and says, everything that I have to say does not hold a candle to what you're saying. He's so convicted and so convinced by Augustine that he himself becomes a Christian at the end of the debate. Have you ever seen a debate won that badly? How about a presidential debate where one of them just says, well, that's it, I'm joining your party. I'm voting for you. Everybody vote for this guy. He's better than me. Wouldn't that be great? Hallelujah. Well, that's what happened. Augustine wins this debate so handily that the other guy converts to Christianity. You don't have to be a Democrat or a Republican to be a Christian. It doesn't matter whether you are or you aren't. That's not the big issue. But I want to tell you a quick story. When I was in college, I was a registered Democrat. I had this friend who lived across the hall from me, who was just dyed-in-the-wool Republican. And I went over there and I started talking to him, and I said, Democrats are nicer. We need to be nice. You just need to be nice to people. And he's like, well, what does nice mean? What does nice mean? I mean, helping. Anyways, he just went on. And at the end of the argument, I was so frustrated. I did not know what to say. A month later, I was a Republican. I'm not saying Republicans need to be nice. Republicans need to take care of the poor. You need to be a Christian Democrat or a Christian Republican. And I don't care which one you are, but you better be all out for Jesus on either side of that. The problem is how are you going to be all out for Jesus on the issue of abortion? It's a huge issue. How are you going to be all out for Jesus on the issue of homosexuality? How are you going to be all out for Jesus on some of these incredibly important values-oriented points? It's those issues that really, that shade, that push more Christians into one camp than the other. That's where it's important. But whether you're in one camp or the other, you'd be all out Christian. You'd be all out for Christ. You'd be all out for Christ. And you've got to be, you can't do abortions. You can be a Christian Democrat, but you can't be all out for homosexuality or abortion. You just can't. And come talk to me after this and we'll talk about it if these are issues for you. I mean, I'm not saying you've got to believe just like me, but deal with those issues. Homosexuality and abortion have nothing to do with the Christ or the Scriptures. So you've got to reconcile those things. You've really got to reconcile that. And those are things for you to work out, but work through them, because important points. Doesn't mean that if someone has had an abortion in their past, if someone's cousin or brother or sister, parents, whoever, somebody close to you is involved in homosexuality or been involved in abortion or things like this, just because that's close to you doesn't mean that you have to believe that way. Many times people who have had abortions, they have to just make their whole theology line up with that, their whole system of belief. It doesn't. So there's forgiveness. You can change. You can get right with God. And you can recognize right from wrong. And then you'll have the right thing to say. A guy stood across from me in college and said, last night, somebody came up, last night I had my first homosexual relationship. What do I do? Am I gay? You need to have the answers. You're going to need to deal with people like that. You're going to need to know what to say and talk to them with compassion and with love, but with the truth. And so Augustine of Hippo was a guy who debated the great people of his day and won. He debated the great issues of his day and won, and just to the point where the other guys would just convert to Christianity. The guy didn't just kind of go, oh, 60% for me and 40% for you. No, I mean, the guy just completely would become Christian. It's awesome. So that was Augustine of Hippo. And his writings and his influence carried a great deal of weight in the early church. Much of what early church doctrine is based on Augustine of Hippo's writings. And the next very, very influential writer of the church is St. Thomas Aquinas. I want you to study him. I want you to get to know just a little bit about him. But St. Thomas Aquinas was an intellectual who really began to systematize theology of his day. Much of what the Roman Catholic Church stands on is a system that was laid out by St. Thomas Aquinas. You want to get to know a little bit about him because really the church really kind of built its foundations on these guys who were the great thinkers of the day. So Augustine, Bishop of Hippo, St. Thomas Aquinas, these are the guys that really formulated the thinking in their day. And Aquinas lived in the 1200s. For fun, you got to learn about St. Francis of Assisi. This guy is just a blast. Everybody should have The Little Flowers of St. Francis. It is the greatest bathroom reading book you've ever gotten. The Little Flowers of St. Francis. He was born in Umbria, Italy, in around 1181 or 1182, and he was raised the son of a nobleman. He could have just gone on and lived this life of ease that he was born into, but he rejected it and went away from it and just totally embraced, totally sold out to the gospel. And his dad was just completely upset about it. His dad just didn't want to have anything to do with it. And eventually his dad had him arrested for being a nut. And he would get away and he would just continue to just practice his faith. And his life was just filled with miracles. And so you got to get this book, The Little Flowers of St. Francis. And it just goes from one little miracle, and they're just little short stories, paragraph, 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 of these just incredible, cute little miracles. It's amazing. St. Francis is said to have dealt with a wolf that was attacking this one village. He went out and he spoke to the wolf. And it's just this really weird style. I mean, the Christianity of his day is so different than the Christianity of ours. So you really have to take it with a grain of salt. But anyways, he preached to this wolf and he says, "Brother Wolf, Brother Wolf." And he reasons with the wolf and the wolf knocks it off. Praise God. Praise God. Yeah, exactly, you know. Brother Rifle, deal with the wolf. But he went and talked to the wolf. Hey, St. Francis of Assisi, you gotta kinda look at some of his writings. They're fascinating. And the Franciscans were the monks that followed after him. Just tremendous humility. That's one of the great marks of these guys, is that just tremendous preferring of the other. And if they would ever find any jealousy in their hearts, it seems like Brother Filippo is getting better treated than Brother Dominic. If they were feeling any jealousy or any sort of slight in their heart, they would just go through great pains to just get that out of themselves, so that they would just be absolutely pure in all their thoughts, everything. It's precious when you just read about these guys. So Little Flowers of St. Francis is something you really want to get a hold of and have in your library.